Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You are listening to my podcast in one of two ways. Either you are at the blog, lordgaul.podbean.com. I upload a show to that, a podcast to that once a week or once every other week, just depending upon my schedule. As I'm a full-time trainer, I am a striking coach for several mixed martial artists at the UFC level. And also, I want to thank all the people who, you know, gave me congratulations and so on while I was out in Vegas. I was able to help Cody Pfister get his first UFC win. He's a guy who came to me literally 3 weeks before his fight, and we were able to put together a game plan. And though he took a lot of low kicks, he was able to have success in the second and third round. So I appreciate the people who contacted me on Facebook and the people who, you know, saw me in person out in Vegas. I really appreciate it because I do love to help people accomplish their dreams. And it's really cool to see people's family come up, give them hugs, congratulations, childhood friends, see people accomplish that goal. Also, you are listening to my podcast in the most efficient way, which is LORDGAUL or Warman Kickfighting Show on iTunes. Just enter either of those two names and my show pops right up. You'll get the upload of the show once a week or bi-weekly, and I'll do my best to try to stay regular at that. Also, for the Twitter followers out there, twitter.com/StephenTheWarman. So I'm going to go ahead and get into it. There's a couple of major kickboxing events that happened over the past weekend, and of course some, you know, names that we've heard before, or that you've heard before in the show, doing big things on a regular basis. I definitely want to give them a shout out on the Infusion card that I'm going to talk about as well. So let's go ahead and jump into the big one. We go back to Japan, and in Japan we've got the K1 World Grand Prix 70kg tournament. This, of course, was once the pinnacle of the sport. This was the event that most reflected high level of skill in kickboxing. Like, this was the IT division. Thanks to Masato, thanks to Albert Krauss, thanks to Bukau, thanks to Andy Sauer. This was the division. Mike Zambezi's got to throw him in there too. Later, Artur Kachinko made his name. The people who are stars now. One thing I've got to give Robin van Roosmalen credit for, as he's considered, you know, one of the top two 70kg fighters in the world. He's the first era of guy to do it outside of the K1 World Grand Prix 70kg tournament. He had to figure it out. You know, he did it with the It's Showtime tournament win, and then, of course, by becoming the glory champion of the world. But K1 had some down moments, lost all of its fighters, thanks to, for those who don't know, once upon a time, the guys who run Glory now, they wanted to buy K1 originally. It was too difficult for them to buy K1 because of, you know, old bills that K1 had and arrangements that K1 had. So it was just simpler for them to start their own organization. The two heads met, Pierre Andron. He was able to meet with another group, and those two groups were separately trying to buy the K1, and then they got together, and then they made their own organization, and then they got with Simon Roots, who managed like 90% of the K1 roster and was able to get all of the fighters by buying the management company, and that's how Glory got started. When that happened, it meant that the best 70kg fighters in the world no longer reflected, you know, having these elite-level fighters, all the best fighters in the world. With that said, 70kg is such a deep weight class in the world that you could still put together a pretty good tournament. And this tournament was okay. It wasn't great, but it was solid. It had some solid talent, some names that you definitely want to consider, you know, top 15 fighters in the world, guys who fought in Glory, guys who got great international wins. I really think that they did a good job of putting this tournament together. You know, because K1, since that break, K1 was able to get some guys who run it, and they knew how to run it off of its budget. So they stayed in places where the Asian community and the Asian audience were still very much into the K1 brand. They keep it in Japan. They focused on the smaller weight classes. 70kg is the biggest tournament that I believe they have. I don't think they're going to do the heavyweights. But kept it in Japan. Huge numbers of shows in China, signed guys like Sanchai and Bukau until his contract ran up, but he was the guy who kind of, you know, got them some good ratings and some international recognition with his participation last year, despite, you know, what happened in their K1 Grand Prix final. This is a bounce back from what happened in last year's K1 Grand Prix, where, of course, it came down to one fight. It wasn't a one-night tournament. That one was done over several weeks. Did give us an opportunity to see Maximo Suarez and Enrico Kiel get you know, international notice for how skilled they were and the performances that they put on. Bukau, of course, did really good things. Paul Daly, the MMA fighter fighting kickboxing, he had some good opportunities. I think that their last year, though, when they ended on the note of Bukau, you know, in a close fight, I thought that a draw was, I'm completely fine with a draw and going to an extra round. Bukau had heard, you know, the story is, of course, that he heard that there was some, you know, arrangement for him to lose no matter what. And he was going to go to an extra, and then the extra he was going to lose. No matter what, he was going to lose. It was going to go against him. He had heard that. So after he had fought three rounds, he didn't even stay to hear the decision. He just left the building and said, I'm going to let the fans judge for themselves. Now, he's got, you know, he's got a history of having these kind of, you know, situations happen in his dealings with K1. But I can't stress to you enough that that's a sour taste to have in your mouth. And it's tough for that person to be considered the best 70kg fighter in the world, despite the fact that Enrico Kiel did his job, went out there, performed to the best of his ability, and he was ready to go after it in the extra round if it came down to it. But it did not come down to it. Instead, he was pretty much forfeited the title. You never want it to end that way. Not so much the case here. Murat Gregorian is your 70kg World Grand Prix champion, despite the fact that that means he is a significant fighter in the world, not necessarily the best fighter in the world, or not even necessarily top five fighter in the world. He just lost to Yosin Klai not too long ago. But I do want to break down these fights, and I want to give him his due and talk about where I think he sits in the world of kickboxing. I'm going to go ahead and start. I'm going to break down the tournament fights, then I'm going to go to the super fights because there were some significant ones. First, we'll hit up the reserves. See here, Adamczyk gets a victory over Kazuya Akimoto. And I had talked about it before. This is a split decision, so it was closer than I thought. Adamczyk, I think, is one of the more skilled guys. I still prefer him at 65 kgs. I prefer him a little bit smaller, but he's very slick as a southpaw. That straight left hand scores. He gets off center. He's got good turns. He's got the perfect type of kicking offense that works towards his style. He more kicks, not just significant kicks, but kicks that put you off balance and kicks that keep you from countering back, keep you from staying in the pocket and throwing with him. Because as soon as he scores him, he gets that foot back on the ground and he's out of there. This was a close battle. Kazuya did, you know, much better than I thought. I thought it was going to be one-sided. But Adamczyk gets the split decision victory, and he would have been key to hop into the tournament had the opportunity to open it up, which it did not. I'm going to go ahead and start first fight in the card. First fight of the tournament, Murat Gregorian gets a KO victory over Yoichi Yamazaki. And in this fight, the left high kick that scored was just a culmination of the work Gregorian had already put in. Style-wise, I knew he had the first one. Like, I knew he was going to push the pace, you know, really let his hands go. But the big key, and in tournaments you hear this a lot, getting stoppages are key, but luck has a lot to do with it. And he was able to stay healthy despite his style because he throws so much offense and he pushes the pace. That's why I always say, man, let's see this guy third fight in a tournament. I feel like he's going to slow down significantly just depending upon the guy that he fights. This tournament, because he was able to get stoppages in all three fights, it kept him from ever getting to that point. Murat Gregorian comes out, puts on an awesome performance against Yamazaki, gets the left high kick KO, just awesome stuff, and he moved on to the next fight. Also, shout out to Nicky Hammers. Nicky Hammers was his coach for this. Gregorian, he has spent a lot of time. Of course, he got his start in Belgium, and where he was with Coach Sommers, one of the more notable females, you know, both boxing and kickboxing coaches on the scene. Definitely shout out to her. But this was Nicky Hammers really getting that combination flow down and getting him to do a better job of walking people into position. Because when he fought Adamczyk, I mean, just a month ago in Glory, he didn't have that, but for one round, he was able to walk Adamczyk down. For the other rounds, he was just running into offense, and he was chasing Sahi, who just kept turning him. Adamczyk is a very slick guy, and Murat Gregorian had his moments in the second round, but 1-3, he wasn't able to close the distance. I think this fight, I think that Nicky Hammers did a good job of really honing in his skills, getting him back in the pocket, getting him back to walking people down, and then letting that combination flow. Next fight in the card was the upset. I was so confident Dylan Salvador was going to win this fight. Makahira Keita did a great job of staying with a steady diet of low kicks that ended up, you know, paying dividends in the third as Dylan Salvador was clearly hurt by them. But the key thing in this fight was clearly the ref's decision to intervene every time Dylan Salvador caught the teep leg and fired a low kick behind. That's got to be let go, okay? The whole notion of grabbing and sweeping that stops the action. That's the reason why, even though I'm against it, that's the reason why people started to call that sweep, you know, legal. They feel like it's stopping the action. But if you just control the teep leg, that's the defense to it. The defense to it is to catch it at your body, get it out of the center line, and fire a low kick behind it. That is a basic counter that doesn't affect the flow of kickboxing offense at all. The ref is 100% wrong to call that illegal. I want to see the rule book on that. That includes that in a catch and sweep, because he didn't sweep off of it. Not one time do I recall him catching it, stepping through, and sweeping the plant leg, and then dumping Keita on his back. Every single time, he just caught it, pulled it to the side, and fired a low kick behind. That's the defense. That is a technical defense. Now, I know it's more Thai style. Usually, you'll see in kickboxing, they do more of a you know, kind of like a swipe. They'll take your hand, and they'll kind of do the reverse wax on, wax off, if you will. They'll just pull the kick. They'll you know, take their hand, let's say their left hand, to the right, you know, the right side of their body, and then swing through, and they'll scoop the leg out of the way, and then fire kick behind. I thought the only difference between that and Salvador was Salvador used two hands to lean back, catch the teep on his belly. He pulled it to the outside and he dropped it. It did not affect the flow of the offense. It did not slow the action down. It should not have been called. That was absolute trash by the ref. They got to let that go. Outside of the fact that the ref, you know, pretty much screwed Dylan Salvador over, I thought that Keita's consistent low kick work was the difference, because Salvador didn't. He was a little bit too lackadaisical, maybe thinking a little bit too tournament style, and he didn't get off with the offense that I seen him do before. In particular, when you think, I believe this was Southpaw versus Southpaw, and the thing that made Salvador, who had a huge win over Sitichai earlier this year, the thing that made that such a special fight was he was so aggressive with his low kick game. He just low kick, counter low kick, and if Sitichai does anything to you, you're going to come back with a counter game with a low kick finish. Like he was so mean, so aggressive with his returns. And in this fight, he was just so, I'll get him eventually, and it never happened. I felt like he watched the fight go by, but a lot of it had to be just, you know, it had to be bothersome. It had to be a setback. It had to ruin his flow of kickboxing to have the ref call every single time you do that deep. I believe a point was taken at one period of time. Absolute trash. That is a defensive maneuver. It does not stop the flow of action in a fight. You can't call that. Next fight on the card, Sonny Dahlbeck gets a victory over Hiroki Nakajima. This, of course, is the guy who I thought had the best opportunity. Sonny Dahlbeck is a weird combination of, there are times when he throws so clean, good aggression, uses that right hook really well. His body kick, he uses the body kick a lot more than most people because he spends so much time in Thailand. He's got a good style about him. He's having fun out there all the time. Sonny Dahlbeck is a very entertaining fighter to watch. I always want to see this guy perform. But he gets wild in spots. Like, there are spots where he's just throwing, and he'll get off balance, and if he's lucky, he'll fall into you. This fight, he was able to get two downs in the second round. But man, his offense is just strange how it comes off at times, how wild he gets with his shots. But then he'll clean it up. Like right after he's wild, he's back to being clean. It's weird to watch, but you really got to pay attention to him. He does have decent combination flow. He'll throw 1, 2, 3 and then pop the body kick in there. He'll stay in range of striking. He's not afraid to bite down on the mouthpiece in exchange with you. But man, he can be hittable and a lot, and worse, he can get himself off balance a lot. But he was way too talented for Hiroki Nakajima, a guy who I thought that would have had a decent chance to move to the next round had he been matched differently, but he wasn't. He was matched against Sonny Dahlbeck, and Sonny Dahlbeck stopped him in the second round. Next fight on the card, another stoppage. Jordan Picchio gets a victory over Deki Watabe. Dekai Watabe is the guy who I most thought of the Japanese representatives had the best opportunity to move to the next round. For those who've seen Jordan Piquer fight before, Pukur, I believe I'm pronouncing it right, he has got a very strange style where I'm telling you, he throws crazy power shots, his chin is way up in the air, he doesn't tuck it, like he doesn't seem defensively conscious. He just looks to be like really stiff and throw offense. He reminds me of a more offensive version of Emerald Main. If anybody, you guys are like old school, you know, and not even that old, if you're just paying attention to, you know, the Dutch scene in the early 2000s to mid 2000s, there was a guy named Emerald Mayne. And Emerald Mayne would just walk through your offense. He's another one of Lucien Corbin's guys. Lucien Corbin's got so many different fighters who've got so many different styles. And Emerald Mayne, he kept his chin tucked more than Jordan Pekir did. But it was just the way that he always walked through your offense. He always walked you down. He always threw strong. And he had these weird step up knees and so on. Jordan Pekir is very, very similar. In terms of, he doesn't care about his chin is all the way up in the air. And technically, he throws shots that look a little stiff. His kicks don't come, you know, with the full turn. His knees do hike up pretty high, though. He's got a very strange style about him. With that said, everything he's throwing is trying to kill you. And Watabi couldn't handle that pressure. He couldn't handle somebody throwing kill shots at him for a whole fight. Two downs in the second round puts it away from him. And I'm telling you, you just, Jordan, if you were to, like, teach somebody kickboxing, you'd be like, see this guy? This stuff only works for him. Don't try to fight like this guy. That's who Jordan Pekir is. It's a really, really strange style. Going to go ahead and move through the tournament now. Murat Grigoryan then gets Makihira Ikeda, and he stops him with a left hook to the body. He had gotten hurt earlier in the round, was able to, you know, I believe it was body kick that got it going. And then he kept going with the combination flow, scored downstairs, and then after a series of offense, returned downstairs, and the body blow took it away. Murat Grigoryan, like I said, he was in his flow, and that's where luck comes into play. I thought this period of time he'd be going against Dylan Salvador, a slicker guy who's much tougher to walk down, much tougher to just sit there and exchange with. You got to find your spots. You could still, you know, walk him down and throw your offense, but you just got to be ready for much more of a return. And Salvador, just slick enough, still very skilled, but he didn't make it. Instead, he had scored some solid offense over Keita, not enough offense, and he sends Keita into the next fight. Didn't get all the way from, I mean, you get a little recovery time, but he sent him in there with some decent damage. Murat Grigoryan, after the second round stoppage, probably the healthier of the two at this point, gets the second round stoppage, moves on to the final match. As I mentioned before, Jordan Pekir, that weird offense, it found its market against Sonny Dalbec. He was able to hit Sonny Dalbec, and Sonny Dalbec was able to hit him. Like, they were both, you know, he would take advantage of Sonny being off balance. Both of them were throwing big shots. Both of them were eating good, you know, big shots. But just Pekir was able to sustain more and land some significant shots in that second round. Two downs put Sonny Dalbec away. And it's crazy because, yeah, I'm telling you, the videos are now emerging. You know, I was able to, shout out to Hello Japan on Twitter. I was able to get a version of the K1 World Grand Prix almost immediately after it happened. Like the next day I got it. So I got to watch this event 4.5 hours all the way through. And when I watched, I'm telling you, they've got the small videos of it. Jordan Pekir, he's just head up, like chin is high. He's just looking for kill shots. Looks like he's holding his breath most of the round, but he's able to score so much against Sonny Dalbec, who threw back in moments. And he was scoring when he threw back. He just couldn't sustain as Jordan Pekir was able to weather the storm of those brief and sporadic moments of offense from Sonny Dalbec. And he's able to score two downs in the second. Awesome stuff by Jordan Pekir. Very good sportsmanship by Sonny Dalbec in defeat. We go to the final fight. Final fight, of course. Murat Grigoryan, just an offensive onslaught, got Jordan Pekir in trouble early and got him out of there with the hands. Round one, he was fresher. And Jordan Pekir was coming off of two, you know, stoppage victories, but he came off of those victories throwing kill shots the whole time. Whereas Murat Grigoryan, his pressure offense is what he's been doing for a really, really long time. He's used to throwing that kind of volume. And go ahead and add the fact that he had two stoppages. He pretty much just came in there, you know, I won't necessarily say fresh, but fresher than he normally would be if, you know, he had to do, you know, his level of offense for the, you know, for six rounds before this. But he came in through sharp, mean combinations, and he is your K1 World Grand Prix champion. Awesome KO, by the way, as he got rid of Jordan Pekir. Definitely check that out for the people who haven't seen it. Murat Grigoryan is one of the best fighters in the world. He is a top 10 fighter in the world. He lost a split decision to Robin van Roosmalen. He was very, very close to winning that fight. He's going to always have trouble with people that are slick. A Georgia Petrosian will always give him trouble in the way that, Adamchuk gave him trouble. Like, that is always going to be part of it. Like, it's going to be part of his game if you're slick and you can move a little bit. But if you try to get into a kickboxing flow with him, he'll match you. Plus, he'll be able to walk you down. So, congratulations, Murat Grigoryan. I'm pretty much down with you fighting anybody. Enrico Kiel would be another good fight for you to do next. Georgia Petrosian's still out there as a name. You get the opportunities to fight in Kunlun, so of course that brings, you know, more names. I just want to see you perform more. Mrakagorian having a pretty solid year despite the fact that, you know, he had come off some losses before this. Came off two losses in a row. A loss to Yotsen Klai, lost to Adamchuk. But he was able to put it together this night because that's how it works in tournaments. So congrats. It's unfortunate that Yotsen Klai, who signed to K1 and signed to Kunlun, it's unfortunate that they weren't able to slide him into this tournament because I know it was something that he wanted his whole career. Maybe they'll give him the opportunity next year, but he definitely wanted the opportunity to fight for a K1 World Grand Prix title, and his only opportunity for the promotion was when he fought Kamel El Amrani in, what was it? I'm just drawing a blank. He fought for them one time, and what was it? I want to say the 2003 K1 World Grand Prix. He was on a super fight, and I'm pretty sure I can't remember who it was that he fought. But I knew the guy fought in Super League a lot. So it's just eluding me in the moment. But yeah, definitely good stuff. And I'm really, really excited to see that Yotsen Klai is an option for Mrakagorian. And I'm excited that, Enrico Kiel is an option. And a really good one would be the fight that I mentioned with Maximo Suarez. His style would be really, really good. So definitely want to see these guys compete. And I definitely want to see more from Mrakagorian. Going to go ahead and move into the super fights on this one, and there are a lot of significant ones. Hirotaka Urebe gets an extra round decision over Toshi in that extra round. He scores it down, if I'm remembering correctly. Here's the thing with Urebe. I thought that he was just a little too tentative, and I thought that he allowed rounds to be close because he played such a slower-paced kickboxing performance. But he can crack. So I was expecting him to sit down on his punches and get that big score. He didn't find it until the extra round. He gets a victory over Toshi. Toshi's serviceable. But Hirotaka, of course, it's all about being Koya Robe's brother. That's the guy who's the number one in the division. Hirotaka is embedded at number two. I'm fine with that. But I really think that Urebe is a very good performer, good fighter. Want to see more of him down the road. But in the end, it's all roads lead to Koya Urebe. I got to admit it. It's his second win over on the liver kick rankings. Like I mentioned before, Massaro Glunder, I thought, is, you know, he pulled off a really good upset when he got the, you know, the victory over Masaki Norin, but I wasn't ready to put him in the top 10. And in this fight with Kimura Philip Minoru, Minoru, I thought, was just in the beginning, they were super tentative, and he's looking to throw power shots, and then Glunder caught him with the right hand, dropped him, put him on his butt, 10-8 round, gets the fight going. But Glunder threw almost no offense in this fight. In every round, he was tentative. He never felt confident throwing combinations. And when he fought Masaki Nori, it was complete opposite. Masaki Nori was the one that was tentative just because he was aiming to start slow, whereas Glunder came at him, guns blazing, right off the jump. The difference between Glunder fighting Masaki Nori and Glunder fighting Philip Minoru is Minoru was throwing that heat. Minoru was throwing bombs from the beginning of the fight. Every combination he threw had, I'm trying to kill you, Glunder, on them. Like, he was just sitting in the pocket throwing shots. And Glunder was able to avoid a lot of them. But in the end, he was getting walked down. He was on the defense all the time. He never felt confident throwing his offense because he had a guy throwing heat in front of him. Third round, Minoru finally gets a hold of him. I thought it was clear. In my opinion, it went to an extra round, but I thought that it was a clear win after three for Philip Minoru. Because after the second round, which I thought was just a clear, like, Glunder offered almost no offense, and Minoru was continuously pushing the pace, landing big hands, walking Glunder down. Glunder was, always getting, locked in into the clinch, like getting in positions where he wasn't able to throw, really looking to be safe a lot of times. Minoru was able to get after him. Round three, he was able to score the down. The down was a little bit weird. Could have been iffy. Wasn't as clean as some of the other shots I've seen him land. But the writing was on the wall. Minoru was going out there trying to win the fight. Glunder was out there trying to survive the fight. It went to an extra round. Extra round looked like two and three. Minoru throwing that heat. Glunder backing up. And Minoru got this win. I had to, got to give him his due. He's at minimum a top 10 guy in the 65 kg division, which absolutely pains me to say, but it is true because he is a guy who doesn't have the kickboxing flow yet, but he believes in his power. He stays in the pocket. The audience loves him because he is, you know, Brazilian, but he looks like a white dude, and he speaks Japanese fluently. People really, really like him. Good performance by him. Definitely want to see him against Misaki Nori. Definitely want to get, you know, see him against the best 65 kgs. A lot of fun fights out there for him. But, man, I got to give him his due. I thought that he – excuse me – 60, I believe this is, I'm pretty sure 65. But yeah, I definitely want to see him fight more. Very entertaining fighter. Yuta Kuba would be a fun fight for him to put together. So, next super fight I want to talk about is Takuru as he gets a victory over Hakim Hamech. Again, Hamech was, there was down in this fight, but I thought Takuru is going to, you know, as the 55 kg king right now, the champion of that division 4K1's brand, I thought that he was just going to absolutely murder Hakim. And I thought Hakim did a good job of staying in the fight, having movement, having offensive flurries here and there, despite the fact that Takuru was able to just walk him down, throw big hands, just wasn't as consistent as I've seen him before. It was a solid win, but it wasn't a standout performance. Takuru, I thought, was going to get a stoppage in this fight, but still a solid, solid performance. The aforementioned king at 65 kgs, or 60 kgs, I should say, is Koya Urobe. Koya Urobe dominated Konstantin Trishan, and Trishan, I thought, was... It's not that he was dominant in terms of he just absolutely knocked him down all over the place. I just thought that all the offense went in his favor and it was easy to go for him all three rounds. So I won't say dominant, I'd say clear. So definitely think Koya Urobe did his thing. I prefer him to be a little bit meaner because I love his step back work when he throws that, you know, that 3-2 strong. I love when he gets his low kick game going consistently. I thought it was a solid win, but again, not a standout performance. Just a, hey, I am the champion of this division. This is what a one-sided win for me looks like. Last fight in this card I'm going to talk about was Koo Fairtex's absolute clinic over Yosumi Soda. Yosumi Soda, of course, is these two met in the 60 kg tournament last year. And when they met, it was, what was it? I'm trying to remember the exact moment. When these two met, it was what? Excuse me, the 65 kg tournament last year. When these two met, Koo Fairtex had just come off a KO victory over Yuta Kubo in the fight before. Soda had just come over a KO victory over Philip Minoru, speaking of weird. And then they meet in the finals, and Koo Fairtex is able to outscore Soda. Since then, Soda gets another victory. He beats Yuta Kubo. Koo Fairtex coming in after a fight where he was pretty much dominating against Philip Minoru. He gets scored a down scored on him in the third, and they gave the fight to Minoru. I still disagree with that. But Koo Fairtex has since bounced back. He's been winning. Soda's been winning. These two get together to perform and put on what was supposed to be a solid fight. Soda comes out there. He's rocking the Masato music because he changed that. The Silver Wolf gym did him no favors when the fight started. Fairtex, too slick. I'm telling you, the left hand was scoring clean. His combinations were scoring clean. And he didn't bail. He just stepped to the side and he made Soda miss small. And he had kept putting offense on him. Just an absolute clean, technical, just dominant performance by Koo Fairtex. And the thing about it is, I've mentioned you guys before, the ties that people want to see in the international level are like Sitachai types, guys who actually are aggressive and they go for the kill. They don't want you to be sitting there the whole fight, playing the game, scoring teeps, trying to get a win and be clean. Nobody's going to pay you to go across the world to do that. They want to see you letting them hands go. They want to see you put them hands on some people. Koo Fairtex put it all on Soda. And Soda wasn't, it's not that he wasn't trying. He just was in there with a far superior fighter. As Koo Fairtex was always too slick for him, always made him miss small, always had a counter, always had some offense when there was a dull spot in the round. Three rounds of perfection. Koo Fairtex, in my opinion, is the best fighter in the world. At 65 kg, still want to see him fight Koya Urobe. It blows me away that, you know, this guy once had a down. I mean, I'm scratching my head as I think about it. He was just dominating, and he gets caught one time by Minoru, and that was the difference in the fight. Go ahead and make that rematch, because Koo Fairtex will stomp him in the second one. Very, very fun card. Very entertaining all the way through. Like I said, it was 4.5 hours, and I jammed all the way through that thing. It was a lot of fun. So make sure you guys get it. The K1's already on the official K1 YouTube page. They're already posting the fights. Event happened about 2 weeks ago, so you got plenty of time to go check those out. A lot of fun, and it really is a card that people should take note of. Going to go ahead and move on to some notes, as Badr Hari is going to be fighting an Akhmat. And Akhmat is a new promotion that is pretty much run by, I mean, I won't say that they're, you know, drug lords or criminals or whatever. I'll just say that they're questionable in behavior. That is the guys that are running this promotion. It's like a friend of his is putting together a fight promotion, and he's going to fight on it. And it's weird how it goes because, you know, as I think about it, adding to the list of guys that, what was it, who am I forgetting? There was another fight mentioned on that card. That's why I don't want to, you know, just say Akhmat. It's just the fight that they talked about is going to be Badr Hari versus Ismael Lant. Of course, Ismael Lant was once upon a time the guy who was in the long line of guys that were going to be the next superstar in Dutch kickboxing and in the heavyweight division. And only one person, as I said to you guys on this show many times before, only one person fulfilled it to the level that they were supposed to. Remy Bonjasky was supposed to be the next it guy coming out of Holland. And he had some early loss to Errol Parris and guys of that, you know, ilk early on, the Miracle loss early. But he's able to put it together later. And he's able to become a 3-time K-1 World Grand Prix champion. That third one, super impressive, despite the way that it ended with Badr Hari. But, like, he's the only guy to attain it to the level that they wanted to. Badr Hari attained the stardom part of it. Like, his stardom surpassed pretty much any of the guys except for Peter Arts and Ernesto Hoost of Dutch fighters. I think Badr Hari is probably the third most known in the world. But as far as accomplishment goes, the only guy to actually put the titles up with being that next it guy was Remy Bonjasky. It was out of reach for the other guys. Ginty Verdi, of course, you know, passed away before he got the opportunity to try for it. But Badr Hari had the opportunity, got to the finals, wasn't able to get the championship. Ismael Lant, another guy, had a lot of power, didn't have a lot of cardio. He was able to get himself at best in position to win the K-1 World Grand Prix when he met Mirko Krokop, and that one that was pretty much set up. I mean, the trash one that was pretty much a throwaway that they gave to Mirko Krokop, because we all know that Mirko lost in the second fight to Miller. But, man, I'm telling you, this promotion, and you should see the, you know, people who are the back and forth going down over, you know, Kitarov and, you know, his involvement with, you know, suspicious elements or whatever. I don't know him full. I don't know the stories behind them. I'm just saying that there is some, you know, suspicion that these gentlemen are, you know, dealing in, you know, they get their finances through inconspicuous means. And Badr Hari fighting for them goes all the way back to not just my kickboxing documentary, not just the kickboxing documentary done by Stillwell recently. It goes back to the first one that was done in Holland a long time ago, where it talked about how Hari had been, you know, because he was a famous kickboxer, suspicious people had been hanging with him. And he's cool with being friends with whoever. Like, just, I think Badr Hari's got friends that are, you know, in his mosque, and he's got friends that are friends from the street. I just think that that's just who he is. That's just his nature. That's just the person that he is. But when this came about, a lot of people were like, wow, how is it that, you know, there's a possibility that he's connected to, you know, motorcycle gangs and all this kind of stuff, all these people behind the kickboxing world. I can't speak to that. I can't speak to that side of it. I can only bring it up in terms of doing this kickboxing show and giving you guys kickboxing news and saying that those are surrounding stories with this fight. The reason why I want to bring this fight up is because Badr Hari is one of the most skilled heavyweights in the history of kickboxing. This guy not only has a smooth kickboxing, his fight against Glabe Fiatoza is one of the most excellent heavyweight kickboxing performances that I've ever seen in my life. Go watch that fight if you want to see what I'm talking about. It shows simple jab low kick, hook low kick game, his 1-2, his right hand to switch kick counter game that he always plays. He plays a strong cross hook counter game, combinations of low kick. He then goes combination to high kick, scores it, backs his, you know, Glabe Fiatoza up, goes into a flurry, gets up, you know, uses his peel to score behind the glove, scores it down, fight comes back up to the feet, cleans it out. Perfect technical performance. Badahari is capable of that, despite going to prison, despite, you know, all the things that have happened in his life. This guy has legit skill, and he has the ability to try to end a man. Like, he will go out there and try to finish a fight. He's got that skill. It is just now I won't say upsetting, but it's just disappointing when I don't see him fighting at the level that he should be fighting at. He needs to be in the conversation with Rico Verhoeven. It's got to be. He's got to be one of those names. You know what I'm saying? He's got to be up there when you're talking about, you know, Gokhan Saki, when Gokhan Saki returns, you know, no matter where he fights. But Gokhan Saki, and you got to have, you know, Rico Verhoeven, Errol Zimmerman, those guys who have been fighting for that title, you know, Benjamin Adebuyi. Badahari's name's got to be mentioned with them. He's that level of skill. And the fact that he's continuously fighting on smaller organizations. And I remember in the documentary, he's talking about how fighting in Dubai was similar to, you know, fighting for the organization that, you know, he fought before when he said he had heart for it, referring to K1. And I'm like, Ahmad is not that. It's just a promotion that's run by some guys, and hopefully he'll be able to, you know, make some money and have some success and put on a good Badahari show. But man, Badahari needs to be fighting the elite in the world. It is a shame that this talent, he's got plenty of time. What's he, 29, 30? He got 5 years to decide that, you know what, I'm going to go after this glory title again. He is that skilled. But you know that there is some hesitation because UFC, they've taken some chances. They have taken some chances with people that they have signed and, you know, some of them have had some questionable backgrounds, and some people have had to, you know, back some people, separate themselves from other people. It's come into play for sure. But, man, I can't tell you enough that despite, you know, what kickboxing is, despite the fact that there's a lot of smaller organizations giving people high-level opportunities, despite the fact that there's Kunlun, despite the fact that Badahari has all his issues and so on, he needs to be at the top of the kickboxing world, fighting the best in the world on the biggest promotion. He is that level of talent, and he's got that level of interest in him. Hopefully, Badahari can make his way back to a major organization. There's a couple other people on the card. I just can't think of their names off the top of my head. But man, he needs to be fighting the elite. Gonna go ahead and go to the Infusion card. That's I'm gonna wrap the show up. Not a lot of fights on the Infusion card that I want to talk about. Most of them were smaller level guys improving their skill set, hopefully getting big fights down the road. But I want to single out three. Gergo Bodis, you know, loses by stoppage KO to Keith Levin's second round stoppage. And in this fight, it's weird watching their styles because Gergo Bodis came in, if you listen to the kind of pre-hype fight, basically when the guys are and girls are doing their walkout, instead of you watching them walk to the ring, the way they did the production on this one is they shot away to like a vid of them, you know, talking about their preparation for the fight and what they thought was going to happen and so on. And Gergo was talking about how he was an ex-soldier from I forget what country he was from originally, and you know, he'd been trained in Ireland for a while. Keith Levin's local favorite, he comes in there. Gergo Bodis had, you know, some things happen to him in the first round where he took some low blows. Neither guy got their kickboxing flow going a lot, but Keith Levin's got his going more. Scored a lot of effective offense and was able to, you know, turn the fight in his favor after he had got Gergo Bodis in trouble. Bodis tried to kind of walk away, and then Keith Levin's followed and dropped a right hand that just dropped him clean. Gergo Bodis rolled over, was helped up kind of to his, you know, to sit to a sitting position. He's able to get up to his feet, and then the moment he got to his feet, they were done counting. They said, that's the fight. There's no fight. And he was over there complaining, completely clear-headed, wondering why they stopped the fight, making an argument, saying that's trash, kind of having a, you know, like, a, I can't believe the smile, looking to the audience. It was a really, really weird moment. Here is why, not even just looking at the KO, but this is 100% why this fight was called correctly when it was called a KO. If you fall during a fight and people outside of the fight help you to your feet, the fight is over. He fell, I don't know if it was his corner, I think it was his corner, but he fell like lifeless. Like for those who watched the UFC fights the other night, how Duffy kind of had that lifeless kind of fall. He fell lifeless, knocked out, you know, from a shot from the side. He fell face first. And the moment he hits the ground, the people that are on the outside, they reach in and they help to turn his body over, because you don't want to be, you know, laying out cold, you know, flat in your face, you know, like, you know, Pacquiao style. You want to lay, get these people so they're looking up, like start to, you know, get themselves conscious. If he came to during that moment, got up to his feet and wanted to go again, I can understand it. But when you fall like that and people from outside, it's not like he fell out of the ropes. He fell dead in front of them, right under, like, on the ropes, right in the, by that, the turnbuckle, right by them. And all they did was roll him over, like, this fight's done. The ref's like, this fight's done. That fight's called, okay? I know it might suck if you're a fighter, because you didn't tell the people outside the ropes to help you, but you couldn't have been dropped any more than that. I'll hear no argument. That was a good shot. Good punch scored. And we'll see what happens moving forward with both athletes. But Keith Levins, he's going to have to clean it up if he's going to beat some of the more elite guys. In particular, there's so many strong guys in that are champions in the weight classes. But we will see moving forward. Iman Barlow, once again victorious. She defends her Infusion title. It's crazy. I watched her, you know, win the title like three years ago, it feels. And she's just continued to hold on to it. Her only loss, she said two losses since that time. One of the fights wasn't for a title, which is weird. But the other fight, of course, was on the reality show. She's continuing to be on a hot streak this year. She's continuing to win fights this year. This fight over Samantha Van Doorn. Samantha Van Doorn was in a really, really good fight. You know, recently, what was it? She was in a four-woman tournament. I can't remember the date of it, but she went against Iona Wymans in that fight. And that final fight was just an awesome kickboxing match. When she, the first round, she had a moment where she kept moving, low kick, got into her combination flow. It all looked good for a little bit. But then, all of a sudden, Iman Barlow started to score knees like crazy. Step-up knees, knees in the clinch, jumping knees. She would throw the body kicks to slow to get her to get Samantha Van Doorn from moving left and right all the time. As soon as she stopped, right down the middle with the big knees. And it continued to be this way for five rounds. Just dominant work in the clinch. You know, as the commentator was talking, there was, you know, Finney Shormer was referring to how the Dutch don't clinch that much, that they're not the greatest clinchers. And because they focus on kickboxing flow, it's really true. Then again, you got to find your coach. I think that you look at a guy like Lucien Corbin, very much about clinching, very much about the knees. It just kind of depends on who you fight for. But Samantha Van Doorn had nothing for the clinch. She had no pummel. She didn't know how to fight in the arms. She didn't know how to control at the neck, nor did she reach for it. She just kind of put both arms down and got kneed. And then by the fourth and fifth round, as soon as she was in those spots, she would just tip over on her back so that they'd restart the fight in the middle. It wouldn't have been that bad had she just been throwing hands in between. But instead, so tentative of kicks and jumping knees, she just kept her hands in tight and just was right back in the same situation. And rinse and repeat, five rounds of dominance by Iman Barlow. Apparently, both girls don't like each other because of what happened on the Infusion show. Iman beat her on that show as well. Samantha Van Doorn took the fight confident. And for moments in the first round, you could see what she was seeing. Her combination to kick flow was solid when she landed it the one or two times she did. And then when she kept running, you know, walking Iman into the low kicks, she did okay. But then again, Iman Barlow, you know, 15 minutes, it's difficult to pull off anything against her. She's seen it all. She was able to close the distance. She knew what Samantha Van Doorn was going to do from the first fight, and she was able to get the five-round victory and retain her 54-kg title and Infusion. Last fight I'm going to talk about on the podcast is Ilias Belaud's awesome KO over Simon Santana. It's just, it's why he is the spectacle, as he was calling himself. Why it is fireworks. He's just got this amazing ability to just explode with just some offense that you haven't seen before. He was putting together his regular kick combo flow. If you kick him, there's no way you're getting away without getting kicked back. His kick return game is solid. But when he did his step around, he threw that walkover knee that came up. It reminded me of the KO victory that we got from Muhammad Jiraiya when he was on the Fight Rookies show. He had a walkover knee like that. What I mean by walkover is there is a motion where both of your hips and your feet move as one as they pursue a fighter, and then all of a sudden the knee comes up really high and scores well. Like, it's just your hips are switching and then you fire the knee up. In that way, he walked towards Santana as Santana was backing up. The right hip comes forward, Right leg is planted, fires the left knee up, as opposed to throwing it straight down the middle. It comes from the outside, kind of like a knee kick coming high, and it scored clean. Clean KO, leaving Simon Santana knocked out, head laying on the bottom rope, looking up at the sky. Again, Elias Bilal at first is doing this through Ramadan. They had Ramadan training. They still train twice a day. They just had to train later at night so that he could, you know, in the second session, I believe, so that he can get his, you know, food in and so on. But the kid is just one of the best in the world. 65 kgs. K1, you've used him before, you got to bring him back. The kid is just absolutely awesome, awesome entertainment. So that's my show. I'm glad for everybody that followed. I'll be back next week. I'm trying to get my State of the Game episode going. But like I said, I got busy with the festivities last week because that UFC week was pretty crazy last week. So when I went out there to prepare my fighter, it was a tough one, you know, to kind of get back to the podcast and then focus on your fighter making weight. It just wasn't responsible, so I focused on my guy. We got the win, came back with the podcast today. So hope you all enjoyed it. I'll be back next week, and thanks for supporting the kickboxing game. God bless and love you all. Peace, fans.